executive producer Isaac Saul. This is Tangle.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the Tangle Podcast, a place we get views from across the political spectrum, some independent thinking, and a little bit of my take. Today is Wednesday, November 8th, and we are going to be covering the election results from last night. There were several big elections happening in states and state houses across the country. We're going to talk about what exactly happened and what we might take away from it. Before we jump into that story, I want to give a quick preview of something that is coming on Friday. Those of you who follow me on Twitter might know that the last few days have involved a little bit of controversy. On Monday, I moderated a fiery conversation for our YouTube channel and this podcast. My two guests were Hussein Abubakar Mansour, an Arab intellectual who grew up in Egypt, hating Israel, but became pro-Israel as he learned more about the issue, and Dan Cohen, an American Jew who grew up thinking Israel was his homeland, but is now staunchly anti-Zionist. Cohen is a far-left journalist who once worked at Russia Today America. After the show, Mansour expressed his regret on Twitter about joining for the interview, calling Cohen a paid propagandist for his work at the Russia-funded RT, and suggesting I wasn't smart enough to understand what had just happened or the difference between the two of them. Cohen returned fire, calling Mansour a paid propagandist for his work for a group fighting anti-Semitism that has received money from the Israeli government. It was all very messy and got lots of attention in places on the internet that I don't think any of us, including me, should spend too much time sweating over. But I actually thought the conversation was pretty interesting, and about 80% of the debate was kind of illuminating, despite the fact that there was a lot of crosstalk and it got very heated. At the very least, I thought it was a good way to see how two people who strongly disagree on this issue can frame the same events in such different ways. So we'll be releasing the video and the podcast to everyone this Friday on Veterans Day, despite the fact that it's typically a day off for us. This is simply me giving you a heads up to keep an eye out for it. I also want to let you know I am traveling tomorrow. So John Lull, our podcast editor, who also happens to have a silky smooth voice, will be tagging in for me on the pod tomorrow. All right, with that little preview out of the way, we're going to jump in today with some quick hits. First up, the House voted 234 to 188 to censure Democratic Representative Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, the lone Palestinian American in Congress, for her rhetoric about the Israel-Hamas war. More than 20 Democrats joined Republicans in the vote. A censure carries no practical impact, but it is considered a severe condemnation from colleagues. Number two, House Republicans pulled their version of the 2024 transportation and housing spending bill from the floor after it became clear they didn't have the votes to pass it. Number three, parts of the U.S. Capitol complex went on lockdown yesterday after a man with a rifle was spotted near the Senate offices. After refusing to put down the gun, the 21-year-old was tased and arrested. Number four, President Biden urged Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to agree to a three-day pause in fighting to allow the release of more hostages and delivery of humanitarian aid. Number five, in oral arguments, the Supreme Court appears likely to uphold the legality of a law that makes it a crime for people with domestic violence restraining orders to purchase a gun. And finally, a brief reminder, the third Republican debate takes place tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern Time in Miami.
It was a big election night for Democrats across the country as the party scored victories in Ohio, Kentucky, and Virginia.
Notable wins include Ohio, which voted to enshrine abortion rights at the state level, Virginia, where Democrats will now control both the state and Senate and House of Delegates, and in Kentucky, where Democratic Governor Andy Beshear was reelected to a second term.
Yesterday, voters across the United States cast ballots in gubernatorial races, state House races, state Supreme Court races, and on ballot measures related to abortion and marijuana. In most of the contested and closely watched elections, Democrats and abortion rights activists prevailed. In Virginia, voters flipped the House of Delegates back to Democratic control and preserved a Democratic majority in the state Senate. The win came after Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin campaigned on a promise to pass abortion restrictions if Republicans won control of both chambers. Specifically, Youngkin promised to pass a ban on abortions after 15 weeks, with exceptions for rape, incest, and threats to the mother's life. His anti-abortion message, which is somewhat moderate nationally, was being closely watched by national Republicans. Virginia is the only southern state that has not implemented abortion bans since Roe v. Wade fell. The 100-seat Virginia House of Delegates went 51-47 in favor of Democrats, with two races too close to call as of publication. Democrats also won 21 seats in the 40-member Senate, with one race still too close to call as of publication. If Democrats lose that race, they would still have a majority, but it would be a net gain for Republicans in the state Senate. In Ohio, voters approved a constitutional amendment that ensures access to abortion, the latest major victory for state-level abortion rights since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Ohio, where former President Donald Trump beat President Biden by 8 points in 2020, became the seventh state where voters instituted a constitutional protection for abortion access. It was the only state to consider a statewide abortion question this year. The state's ballot measure, Issue 1, declared an individual's right to make and carry out one's own reproductive decisions, which encompasses abortion, birth control, fertility treatments, and miscarriages. The amendment allows the state to regulate abortion after fetal viability, which was defined as the point where the fetus has a significant likelihood of survival outside the womb. 56.6% of voters voted yes for the measure, while 43.4% voted against it. In Kentucky, Democratic Governor Andy Beshear defeated his Republican challenger, Daniel Cameron. Beshear held on to the governor's mansion in a ruby-red state that Trump won by 26 points in 2020, despite the fact Trump and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell from Kentucky came together to endorse his opponent. Beshear made abortion a centerpiece of his campaign, while Cameron tried to tie him to President Biden. Beshear also received praise for cultivating his own personal brand separate from the National Democratic Party, with a focus on state and local economic issues, which has earned him the highest approval rating of any Democratic governor in the country. At the time of publication, Beshear was leading the race with 52.5% of the vote to Cameron's 47.5%, with over 95% of votes tallied. In Pennsylvania, Democrat Dan McCaffrey was elected to the state Supreme Court, extending Democrats' majority to 5-2. Both Democrats and Republicans invested heavily in the race, with more than $20 million pouring into the election from the candidates' campaigns and outside groups, who saw the contest as a referendum on abortion rights and mail-in voting. In a close 2024 presidential race, the court is expected to navigate a slew of election challenges, as it had to after 2020. Carolyn Carluccio, McCaffrey's opponent, drew national attention during the race for initially telling the Philadelphia Inquirer's editorial board she had no idea if Biden won the 2020 election before backtracking on her comments. McCaffrey won 51.4% of the vote to Carluccio's 45.7%. The people have spoken, and while the outcome was not what we hoped for, the democratic process has once again prevailed, Carluccio said after the race was called for McCaffrey. I want to express my deepest gratitude to my supporters for your time and your belief in our vision for a fair and impartial judiciary. In Mississippi, Republican Governor Tate Reeves won re-election, fending off a challenge from Democratic candidate Brandon Presley. Mississippi has not had a Democratic governor in over two decades, and Presley staged a surprising challenge, with polls showing a close race leading up to Election Day. Ultimately, though, Reeves, who was first elected governor in 2019, won the race comfortably with 51.8% of the vote to Presley's 46.9%. The race was one of the few bright spots on the night for Republicans nationally, but was disrupted by issues at polling places after the state's largest county ran out of ballots and voters had to wait in long lines to cast a vote. A local judge in the Democratic stronghold ordered the polls to stay open an extra hour, and the county commissioners, all Democrats, took blame for the mess, saying they had underestimated the turnout and were ill-prepared. Elsewhere, Democrat Gabriel Ammo won the Rhode Island special election for the 1st Congressional District, becoming the first person of color to represent Rhode Island in Congress. In Philadelphia, Democrat Cheryl Parker became the first woman to be mayor of the city, running on a platform that included pledging to hire hundreds of cops and reinstating stop-and-frisk tactics. In New York, Yousef Salam, the Democrat who is one of the exonerated members of the Central Park Five and spent decades wrongly imprisoned, won a city council seat in Harlem. Along with passing the constitutional protections for abortion, Ohioans also voted to legalize marijuana for recreational use, becoming the 24th state to do so. In St. Louis Park, a suburb of Minneapolis, Minnesota, voters chose city council member Nadia Muhammad as their next mayor. Muhammad is believed to be the first Somali American elected as mayor of a U.S. city. Today, we're going to take a look at some commentary about the night from the right and the left, and then my take. First up, we'll start with what the right is saying. The right is disappointed by the results and concerned about Republicans' string of election losses since the Dobbs decision. Some say conservatives should remain committed to the pro-life cause, but accept compromise on the issue. Others place the blame for the party's underperformance squarely on Trump. National Review's editors said conservatives should take the long view on the fight for life. The adversaries and false friends of the pro-life movement will undoubtedly use this loss to try to convince pro-lifers that their cause is politically toxic and that they just ought to give up. In the mind of anyone who knows the truth that abortion deliberately kills an innocent human being, giving up on the most important human rights cause of our time is unthinkable, the editor said. But the loss in Ohio does occasion a clear-eyed assessment of the challenges the pro-life movement faces now and what will likely be a long battle ahead. In the long term, the pro-life movement needs to change many more hearts and minds of Americans to win a long-lasting victory across the country. Such change will likely involve seeking incremental gains and prudent legislative compromises, the editor said. Advocates of same-sex marriage suffered a string of 32 losses at the ballot box before succeeding for the first time in the bluest of states in 2012. We disagreed with their objective, and both sides are more entrenched on the abortion issue, but their success serves as a reminder that a string of defeats at the ballot box is no reason to believe a cause is lost. In PJ Media, Matt Margolis asks, what the heck happened in Kentucky? If you said in 2019, after Democrat Andy Beshear was elected governor of Kentucky, that he would get reelected 4 years later, I would have said, not a chance. He ran against notoriously corrupt and incredibly unpopular Republican incumbent Matt Bevin. It was a victory by the slimmest of margins under a unique set of circumstances that certainly would be corrected 4 years later. And on Tuesday night, it wasn't, Margolis said. Contrary to what many in the media and the Democratic Party will say, this election wasn't a referendum on Trump or a warning sign that 2024 is going to be bad for the GOP. There is, however, an alarm bell that the GOP must take note of, Margolis wrote. Beshear made abortion an issue of the campaign and did so effectively. Make no mistake about it, the GOP does have to make some changes if they don't want to lose races like this in the future. In the Washington Examiner, Zachary Faria argued that the GOP needs to stop lying to itself about its Trump losing problem. At some point, Republicans need to look their losing problem in the face. The issue is Donald Trump, and Republicans are going to continue to lose until they recognize that fact, Faria said. Tuesday's results come after Trump-endorsed candidates, particularly those who embraced his stolen election lies, crashed and burned in their 2022 midterm elections. President Joe Biden is wildly unpopular. Voters hate the direction of the country, and for the last 2 years, those voters have kept backing Democrats over Republicans. The common denominator remains the perpetual loser, that is Donald Trump. If the last 2 years are not proof that Trump's current general election polling over Biden is a mirage, nothing will be. Every major GOP loss from the last 2 years can be directly traced back to Trump and the abysmal candidates he has supported or the candidates he has dragged down with the stink of his stolen election absurdities. How many more times do GOP voters want to smash their heads into a wall and hand Democrats the keys to power? All right, that is it for what the right is saying, which brings us to what the left is saying. The left is heartened by the Democrats' strong showing and encouraged the party to continue making abortion its leading issue. Some praise leaders like Andy Beshear for showing that voters will reward competent governance from Democrats, even in conservative states. Others say the results are a rebuke of the narrative that the Biden-led Democratic Party is in trouble in 2024. In Slate, Ryan Teague Beckwith said Glenn Youngkin put all his chips on new restrictions on abortion and lost. Youngkin's focus-grouped and poll-tested big idea was to neutralize the issue of abortion, a losing issue for Republicans since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last year, by focusing on a 15-week ban, with exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother. If the plan had worked, Youngkin would have instantly been a national Republican hero, showing the party how to overcome its greatest weakness with suburban women voters in a key state. That was about as likely to happen as, well, Larry Hogan or Chris Christie beating Trump. But it's definitively over now, and Youngkin's abortion plan is a big reason. Voters keep telling Republicans they want to protect access to abortion, Beckwith said. Earlier this year, they flipped the majority in the Wisconsin State Supreme Court over the issue, and on Tuesday, they enshrined abortion rights in the Ohio Constitution. Virginia proved no different. In MSNBC, Terry Carter wrote about why Deep Red Kentucky just reelected its Democratic governor. What's most surprising about Beshear's victory is how unsurprising it is, Carter said. Beshear is one of the most popular governors in the country, and as someone who lives in the heart of rural Trump country, the signs of Cameron's defeat, or lack thereof, have been here all along. During the pandemic, we were looking for a Mr. Rogers-type figure to tell us what to do to stay safe and that, in the end, it was all going to be okay. And there was our governor, no longer called governor, but simply Andy, on our televisions every evening without fail, looking us in the eye. A trusted leader, one of us. After a series of natural disasters in Kentucky, Beshear and his team were visible on the ground, and with the compassion and trust he'd banked during the COVID crisis, he rallied all Kentuckians to support our neighbors, Carter said. One advantage of being the incumbent is you get to use the bulwark of your office to promote your successes. Whether announcing a new investment in Kentucky or delivering checks to small counties like mine for infrastructure, Beshear showed up in person, shook every hand, and garnered much goodwill. In USA Today, Rex Hupke suggested Biden might not be such a drag for Democrats after all. Several political narratives died Tuesday night at the hands of voters, marking a non-tragic and fully deserved end to days of nervous liberal pundit blah blah, Hupke said. On abortion, it's clear Americans continue to not like having their rights taken away, and that spells serious trouble for the Republican Party. Meanwhile, Trump once again showed he's no kingmaker. Biden, following several days of Democratic wailing and worrying about whether he's the party's best bet in the 2024 election, failed to drag Democratic candidates and Democratic-supported initiatives down, which raises the question, why is so much attention paid to Biden's approval ratings and his age when the Republican Party as a whole seems radically out of touch with American voters in blue states and even in some red states? And why is the Democratic guy whose party keeps winning having to justify his re-election bid while the other party embraces an incoherent dude only 3 years younger who keeps leading Republicans to embarrassing election losses while facing 91 state and federal charges? All right, that is it for the left and the right are saying, which brings us to my take. So I find a lot of these results encouraging, not because Democrats won, but because these results demonstrate that voters can separate the issues they are facing locally from the issues that infect all of our national politics. To me, that seems like a good thing. How did a Democrat get reelected governor in a state that went for Trump by 26 points? Voters paid attention to the candidate, not the letter next to his name. How did a state like Virginia elect a widely supported Republican governor and two state chambers run by Democrats? Governor Youngkin made this race about abortion, and Virginia voters didn't like what they heard. How did Ohio, now a Republican stronghold, vote to protect abortion rights and legalize marijuana despite its conservative bona fides? Voters there turned out for an issue they cared about, and party politics don't determine how voters feel about individual issues. I think all of this is a good sign, at least in the sense it paints a picture of a country not so totally drowned in red versus blue national politics that voters can't distinguish between people and issues they care about solely because of which party is saying what. The fact that there are hundreds of thousands of voters in these states casting ballots for both Republicans and Democrats seems like a sign of a healthy democracy to me. The results are also fascinating in that they contrast so heavily with what we just covered yesterday. A national environment sour on President Biden. Aside from Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves, who can breathe a sigh of relief but can hardly feel good about having had a competitive race, Democrats prevailed in basically every race that was being watched closely at the national level. While the party has to deal with the fact its candidate for president is deeply unpopular in polls, Republicans have to deal with the fact that they have underperformed in almost every major election since Donald Trump's 2016 victory. And their losses are even more stark if you start the clock at the fall of Roe v. Wade. It's quite obvious to me that abortion is still central to a lot of what we are witnessing. My piece from a year ago, titled "It's Abortion, Stupid," is aging nicely, and I think it applies to what we just saw in Ohio, Kentucky, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. I also think it is worth pointing out that the obsession with the 2020 election continues to be a loser for Republicans. As a Pennsylvania resident, I was already interested in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court race, but I became especially interested after Carluccio stumbled on a very simple question about whether Biden won in 2020 or not. Regardless of where the candidates land on other issues, that is a red line for me. So in that election, I'm happy to admit I was relieved to see her lose. I'm glad to see a Pennsylvania judiciary coalescing that I can be confident will abide by the will of the people and count my vote properly in 2024. And for all of Beshear's success, it's also true that the best performing statewide GOP candidate in Kentucky was Secretary of State Michael Adams, who strongly rejected talk of a stolen election and dominated his primary challenger. Adams ran on expanding voting rights, which was smart. In 2022, Republicans who denied the results of the 2020 election did 2 points worse on average than their Republican counterparts. Taking all of this together, if you are looking for some kind of overarching narrative to extrapolate from those elections to the national mood, here is what I would offer. President Biden has huge vulnerabilities heading into 2024, but the last few elections paint a very favorable political environment for Democrats. Simon Rosenberg, the Democratic strategist who is one of the few people that rightly predicted the 2020 election results, puts it this way, quote, "I'd rather be us than them," end quote. I think Rosenberg is right that Democrats are stronger on the key issues both nationally and in important swing states. But why? How can that be true when so many people disapprove of the Democratic president? Because voters strongly disagree with Republicans' positions on abortion and election integrity, and because those two issues continue to be the centerpieces of the elections we are witnessing. And while they may not be on voters' minds in these head-to-head polls, they will be front and center in 2024 on Election Day. All the terrible polls for President Biden aren't going to change that, and I'd expect more of the same real-world results unless and until Republicans adopt a new strategy to address them. All right, that is it for my take, which brings us to your questions answered. This one's from Paul in Deerfield, Illinois. Paul said, "Your interview with Dean Phillips raises the question of why you haven't had a similar focus on Marianne Williamson, another potential challenger to Biden." Okay, so I'll start by just conceding my bias here. I don't take Williamson seriously. I do not think she has anything close to the qualifications to be president, and I don't think in any of her previous runs for office, she has demonstrated a realistic understanding of the job she is asking for. Williamson is an author, motivational speaker, and self-help guru running a 2024 presidential campaign on anti-corporate populism and a foreign policy of peace. She is generally very, very left on key issues such as supporting the Green New Deal, universal free pre-K, shutting down nuclear plants, and banning assault weapons. She has faced controversy in the past for calling COVID vaccines draconian and for abusive treatment towards campaign staffers. I think a lot of her positions are divorced from moderates in both parties, and I struggle to see any way she could put a dent in Biden, especially given her trouble simply running an organized campaign. But there are more relevant reasons, too. Williamson is a known commodity who ran in the 2020 Democratic primary well behind not just Biden, but also Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, Andrew Yang, Pete Buttigieg, and even Michael Bloomberg. After RFK Jr. announced his candidacy earlier this year, he consistently polled far better than she did before dropping out of the primary race and deciding to run as an independent. And after the Democratic National Committee announced in the spring that it would not be holding primary debates, that made the story simply about Biden. Would he run or not? For all that time, Williamson has just been a background player, and her impact on national politics is not only slim in my view, but has been proven to be slim in the real world. So I've definitely been less interested in her campaign in our coverage. But this question did make me reevaluate that position because two big things have happened since RFK Jr. dropped out. First, Representative Dean Phillips from Minnesota entered the Democratic primary. Then, the recent New York Times-Siena College poll showed Trump polling well ahead of Biden in swing states. That brought new attention to the primary, which right now has only two people in it with any kind of head-to-head polling numbers, Biden and Williamson. That will change once we see how the voters respond to Phillips. But as it stands right now, you're right to say that Williamson has been getting overlooked. Even in our coverage of Phillips entering the race, we framed it as an unusual challenge to an incumbent, all but dismissing out of hand Williamson's campaign. And again, to be crystal clear, I don't think she has a shot. But even though I don't see a realistic path towards her getting the nomination, she's still in the game. We don't know what her impact will be, and we should be covering her campaign. So, to that end, here's my promise that we'll reach out to her campaign and ask her to come on for an interview. All right, we are skipping our under-the-radar story today because our podcast got a little bit long, which brings us to our numbers section. The number of abortion-related referendums supported by pro-life Democrats that have succeeded since the Dobbs decision in June 2022 is zero. The number of U.S. states that have voted to protect abortion access since the Dobbs decision is 7. The number of U.S. states with a ban on all or most abortions is now 17. Andy Beshear's margin of victory over Republican Matt Bevin in Kentucky's 2019 gubernatorial election was 0.4%. Beshear's margin of victory over Daniel Cameron as of this morning is 5%. Donald Trump's margin of victory over Joe Biden in Kentucky in the 2020 election is 26%. The percentage of people who voted in Ohio in 2023 who said they voted for Biden in 2020 is 46%, according to ABC News exit polls. The percentage of people who voted in Ohio in 2023 who said they voted for Trump in 2020 was 43%. The approximate number of votes cast in New York City in the 2023 election was 313,000. The approximate number of active voters in New York City is 4.6 million. That's a 6.8% turnout. All right. And last but not least, our Have a Nice Day section. A group in the UK is looking to one simple species to help improve the health of its marine ecosystems. In Newcastle upon Tyne on the northeast coast of England, the Wild Oysters Project in the UK just released 10,000 oysters to the water with the belief that the species will improve the environment. Oysters filter their food out of the water and in doing so can filter 50 gallons of water per day or over 100 liters, cleaning out nitrogen and other pollutants. Their reefs also form natural and important breakwaters that reduce storm impacts on the shore. Today marks an important milestone in our journey to restore native oyster reefs to British coastlines, said Wild Oysters Project manager Celine Gamble. We're optimistic that the 10,000 oysters will thrive, reproduce, and grow on the new reef. Good News Network has the story, and there's a link to it in today's episode description. All right, everybody, that is it for today's podcast. As always, if you want to support our work, please go to readtangle.com and consider becoming a member. And don't forget, tomorrow, John Law's filling in on the pod, so stay tuned for his voice and stick around for Friday. We're going to be releasing that very controversial interview on YouTube and the podcast. I'll be right back here in your ears on Monday. Have a good one. Peace. Our podcast is written by me, Isaac Saul, and edited and engineered by John Wall. The script is edited by our managing editor, Ari Weitzman, Will Kaback, Bailey Saul, and Sean Brady. The logo for our podcast was designed by Magdalena Bakova, who is also our social media manager. Music for the podcast was produced by Diet 75. And if you're looking for more from Tangle, please go to readtangle.com and check out our website.